William, let's take some time here and talk about the plan of the Pentagon and what you think is in order since the Soviet Union bit the dust in 1991. What do you think they want to do? And you talked about that in your book, Full Spectrum Dominance.
What becomes clear is that when the Soviet Union collapsed, and collapsed for a variety of reasons, but the Reagan administration had a very active agenda to push that to the breaking point, both with financial pressures on the oil price back in the mid-80s, and also with things like Star Wars, that it was a military buildup that the Pentagon launched, so-called missile defense, that the Russians, and I talked with people who had been prominent Russian economists during the Soviet era, and they told me the straw that broke our back was simply the challenge of keeping up with the American military-industrial complex on developing weapons in space to counter the U.S. advantage. And after that, one would think that the role of NATO would begin to fade away like old soldiers. The Warsaw Pact was dissolved. The Soviet Union was in a shambles. I'd been many times to Moscow since the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 90s to give talks and meet with people in various realms, and I can tell you that they were absolutely devastated and in no way, shape, or form a military threat to the United States or to the Western world. So at that point, a very real agenda, certainly in many European minds, was can we gradually begin to phase out NATO and this nuclear balance of terror that had been built up over the four decades of the Cold War, and start to turn the swords into plowshares and begin to build infrastructure, high-speed rail links, energy grids, and so forth that would incorporate Russia, Ukraine, Poland, and these other formerly communist countries into the economic space of the West and the successful industrial model of countries like Germany, France, and so forth. And instead of that happening, what you had was a Washington agenda that rolled NATO, extended NATO to the east, and brought NATO into Poland, brought NATO into Romania, into Bulgaria, into the Czech Republic, and right up to the door of Moscow, literally. And at that point, when Putin was still president, he began to get more than a little bit alarmed at the fact that the United States seemed to be on an agenda, or the Pentagon, on an agenda of simply encircling Russia and totally decapitating them militarily. And I have to say, if I were in Putin's shoes, I would have good reason to be alarmed myself. So the Western media, our wonderfully unbiased media, such as the New York Times and CNN and BBC, portrayed this as Putin returning to the old Soviet ways of confrontation and so forth. Well, he was simply responding to the confrontation of the Pentagon. The nuclear striking power of the United States arsenal has been refined and upgraded since the end of the Cold War. It hasn't been dismantled. The number of missiles has been reduced, but the firepower and accuracy has been increased, so that the nuclear threat that the U.S. poses to any country that crosses its path is actually increased since the end of the Cold War. The question I have is, why do we, in the year 2011, some 20 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, at all need a North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO?
Right.
Why do we send NATO into countries like Libya, who never invaded a neighbor country, the prerequisite for a UN peacekeeping action, or whatever one wants to call it? Why do we need NATO in Afghanistan? Lord knows that's not the North Atlantic. Are we there to protect the opium harvest for certain banks that make obscene profits on laundering opium money out of Afghanistan for the Karzai family and for their own interests? I mean, Americans have to begin asking their government, asking their congressmen, what is this all about? Give us some honest explanation instead of this hogwash about defending freedom. If we defend this kind of freedom anymore, it's going to kill us.
You know, you are so right on, William. It's scary because I've always suspected all these things, you know, when the Taliban, and let's face it, the Taliban, they weren't Boy Scouts, especially for human rights and things like that. But they did one thing right. They kept the poppy seed production down. And as soon as we went into Afghanistan, it went back up again. It's a huge industry again.
Oh, it's the world's largest, 93%, according to the United Nations, 93% of the opium cultivated from poppy in the world comes out of Afghanistan. And the Taliban, you're quite right, they had reduced it, according, again, to the UN Narcotics Agency, they had reduced the poppium harvest almost to zero as part of their political agenda. And as soon as the U.S. Took over and got rid of the Taliban, the opium harvest began topping all-time records. And the brother of President Karzai, the handpicked U.S. candidate to be president, his brother, as it was reported in the New York Times some years ago, his brother is the warlord of the opium. I have Afghani acquaintances who tell me that it's well known. Karzai is the capo di tutti capo of the Afghan opium industry, and his brother is his right-hand man. And the same brother of Karzai, according to the New York Times, has been working in collaboration with the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States government. At the same time, he's an opium warlord. So you put the dots together. Look at what happened with the CIA and the Mayo tribesmen during the Vietnam War, where Air America and other CIA proprietary airlines were running opium into the streets of Chicago and the West and Europe and so forth, and using that to finance black operations.
Good point, too. Let's talk a little bit, too, about Oil, the Secret War, which is going to be your new book. You once believed in peak oil, didn't you?
Back in 2003, I was really, I have to say, one of the few times I was genuinely puzzled by the clear U.S. agenda under Bush and Cheney of going to war against Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11, even under any stretch of the imagination. But they had immediately refocused the attention on Saddam Hussein as the new Adolf Hitler or some such, and started the war drums pounding for a war on Iraq. Weapons of mass destruction, you remember that great reason for the war, nuclear weapons aimed at the United States, and so forth, all of which turned out to be science fiction dreamed up in some room back in Langley, Virginia somewhere, or in the Pentagon. So at that point, the only plausible explanation I could find for why the United States would risk 45 years of alliance relationships with the Europeans and with the Japanese and others who were all opposed to the war. I mean, Germany and France were openly opposed to going to war over Saddam Hussein. And the only plausible explanation seemed to me this idea that the major oil fields of the world were coming into depletion, and the Pentagon wanted, and the U.S. wanted to, especially keep in mind this was Bush Cheney, and that was an oil, big oil presidency. Cheney, the former head of Halliburton, was the world's largest oil field services company and the world's largest military contractor. So it seemed to be plausible that this was a motivation for the Iraq War, and I wrote a couple of pieces on it at the time.